relatable. And while the male fans thoroughly enjoyed the voluptuous fixins in little clothing, I doubted they would emotionally invest in them and put the effort in to vote for them. Sort of like how not every woman gets taken home to mama. To get the guys to actually care about a female contestant, they needed to be more than a one-dimensional plaything. I had had mostly guy friends my whole life because we shared the same interests. And so that was my approach with the male fans. Let them know we both played video games and read comics and enjoyed a sensible sneaker. I wasn't trying to portray myself as some perfect, unattainable specimen, which had been the formula laid out before us for years. Often the makeup artists, having plenty of girls to prepare who were on the actual TV programs Raw and SmackDown, would be so overwhelmed they would have to prioritize their time. They would rush our makeup, only do half, or skip it altogether. As television rookies, being a part of the show while not looking the part made a lot of the girls insecure. So they would arrive at the arena early and put their impressive makeup skills to work, taking the initiative to prepare themselves for TV. It wasn't an easy task considering the level of perfection a professional makeup artist provided and how we were vying for a spot among a brand. But I think part of the refusal to help us out was a test. The NXT competitions before the all-female season had endured similar second-class citizen treatments in a sort of fraternity-hazing, stripe-earning kind of way. I'd like to assume that's why the dressing room provided for six women, week after week, was the bottom of a staircase covered in tarps, a handicapped bathroom stall, or a room as small as a closet with no tables or chairs. Once, upon noticing a door inside of our locker room, we opened it, only to realize the door led to an actual locker room, and we were literally being housed inside a closet. I didn't have the innate womanly abilities to paint my own face, and so I learned to embrace looking like hot garbage on TV. It was kind of freeing. If I looked crappy on TV, I didn't have to be worried about getting caught in an airport with no makeup on. I would look exactly the same, tired, puffy, and sort of like a hungry squirrel. If I set the bar real low, no one would be disappointed, which is also how I approach most relationships. Without realizing it, I was training the audience and myself to be comfortable not measuring up physically with everyone else. Instead of trying and failing to compete in that department, I embraced being the best version of myself. That started on a visual level, but then went much deeper. When given a microphone, I let my freak flag fly. I talked about robot handshakes, playing Xbox, and eating pizza, and displayed a vast knowledge of pro wrestling history. I made jokes, snort laughed, handed out fist bumps, and acted like my true dorky self. To understand how obscene that kind of behavior was for a woman at the time, one needs to only look at the vignettes used on the main programs to welcome audiences back from commercial break. A stunning blonde was naked in a bathtub, surrounded by candles and strategically placed bubbles, purring, "Welcome back to SmackDown." And often, that was the only time a woman was seen on the show. Unless you count being used as a spare backup dancer for a famous musical guest. But one could argue that was progress in comparison to only a few years earlier, when women competed in evening gown and bra and panties matches. Bouts won by stripping a humiliated opponent to her underwear. It wasn't only a risk to go against the grain so hard. It was a bit disrespectful to so outwardly combat the conventional system. I understood I was probably pissing off my bosses, but I felt for the women who were so amazingly talented but were relegated to roles that focused on their looks and utilized them as glorified props. I wanted to start chipping away at that glass ceiling. I wanted to throw rocks at it, little by little, until I made a crack. If taking a risk and pissing people off meant having even the smallest of shots at changing the landscape for myself and every woman who came after me, then it was a risk worth taking. And it worked. The fan response was overwhelming. Most important, the fans were tired of watching women's wrestling that didn't take itself seriously. They were itching for talented matches with exciting performances. They wanted to rally behind a female performer, not just catcall her. I felt embraced and accepted, like I was the audience's voice in the competition. But not everyone was as hopeful as I was. Back in talent relations, look, we know you can wrestle, and not many women can. We appreciate that. We just want you to understand that it's important to be the full package. Right now, you're the best wrestler in the competition. Our female fans want to dress like you. Our male fans want to hang out and play video games with you. But no one wants to have sex with you. Do you see how that's a problem for us? I don't know how they do things in SCW, but here we have a standard our women are proud to stand up to. Well, fuck. How exactly does one respond to that? Should I wait until I get back to the privacy of the locker room slash closet, or should I just break down in tears right now? After all my hard work and actual, tangible success, taking a different route, everything still came down to how fuckable I was. And apparently, I wasn't very. In all fairness, I understood where he was coming from. At the end of the day, this business had a long-standing, proven formula for moderate success. Executives had accepted that their women could sell posters and calendars, but would not spike the ratings. Women's matches were often put in between two very important male matches as a way to give the audience a break from action. While the women wrestled, the fans could relax, build up their energy for the next match that actually mattered, and take a bathroom break if needed. This was a real accepted strategy when putting a show together. A fluffy women's match was meant to help the fans catch their breath. When a show was running overtime and minutes needed to be cut, the sacrificial lamb was always the women's match. They did not receive high ratings, and thus it made sense to throw 10 women into one 30-second match. Literally 30 fucking seconds. The mentality was, hey, look at all these hot chicks. But don't worry, they won't bore you for too long. That was the landscape I was entering. That was the landscape I was determined to change. And as I listened to the rest of his well-meaning advice on considering going blonde, I wondered, has any man ever been asked to step up his sex appeal in the name of job performance? I was kicked off the show that evening. I decided to flip off the system one last time before I went back to training at SCW for the foreseeable future. When a contestant was kicked off, he or she was allowed to say goodbye to the audience, and most took this moment to say a quick, thank you, or you got it wrong. This was the send-off speech I came up with, on the spot, while choking on tears. I know I'm not a supermodel. I know I'm the girl that didn't go to prom and stayed home to play video games. But I think that's the girl you guys are ready to have as a diva. I think that it's time that a diva represents every single girl in the audience watching. A girl that every single guy would want to hang out with. I have wanted this my entire life, and I have fought to get here. Every step I have taken has been for this moment to be in this ring. There is not one thing that is going to stop me. I will be back, and I'm going to accomplish all of my dreams. Thank you so much for every single second. You will see me again. Back down at SCW, a new title had been created for the women's division, and this time it wasn't a sparkly crown. The Women of Developmental finally had an actual title belt to compete for. Sure, it was bright pink and had two mudflat ladies adorning it, but as long as it wasn't a piece of jewelry, I considered it progress. When I became the first woman to have held both the Queen of SCW and SCW Divas Champion titles, I was proud to make history. But ultimately, I knew what holding a title in FCW meant. It meant I wasn't going anywhere anytime soon. But everyone expects sex from you. Growing up, surrounded by guy friends and idolizing my brother, it took me a while to realize I had a vagina. And it took me even longer to realize how much of a problem that was going to be. As kids, we don't necessarily see our limitations through gender. For the most part, we are just an asexual pair of jam hands on an indestructible Gumby body. Sure, I once had a boy tell me I wasn't invited to play tag because girls are slow, but I just showed him how fast I could sock him in the thigh, and he relented. As we get older, simply beating people up to prove our worth isn't going to achieve the same results. But boy, have I wanted to try. Believe it or not, being told the majority of America did not want to penetrate me wasn't the meanest thing a guy has ever told me. But having it happen not only in the workplace, but also in the job of my dreams, held a different kind of weight. Suddenly, sexiness was not an option. It was a prerequisite. And as I continued to work with large groups of women, I realized I wasn't alone. For women in every field and facet of life, there is some expectation of physical beauty. It is as if simply having a vagina has signed us to a lifetime contract with Sephora Cosmetics. A period is a literal blood oath to join the never-ending quest for physical perfection. But why? Part of the answer is that for generations upon generations, men have been preconditioned to put this pressure on women. Not all men, but enough for it to be a problem in this modern age. If you are one of the good ones to whom this does not apply, high five, brother. May your manners and respectful treatment of women get you laid like a bandit. But there are a great deal of other men who just believe it is a woman's duty to look good. That is what society has raised them to believe, that we are here for their viewing pleasure. And to deny them of this means we have failed at being a woman. And they think if you're not going to put the effort in to look attractive, at least don't make the cardinal sin of being unappealing. If a woman is not a giggling, lilting flower, a lot of guys will just assume she's having her period or is a cold shrew, instead of considering that maybe he's just not that funny. Just because you are a man does not mean I have to giggle at your jokes. I don't owe you anything just because I have a vagina. And I owe no one a goddamn smile. If a woman makes eye contact with a man and doesn't grin, chances are that guy is going to call her a bitch in his head. Or sometimes he will just yell it at her loudly for displeasing him. Men, this is a real thing that happens to your mothers, sisters, and girlfriends when you are not around. Then, there are the obnoxious bunch that will just go ahead and make a demand of her face, while using a voice that would imply he's gifting her with attention. Smile, guys will tell complete strangers, when they really mean, why are you not trying to get me to sleep with you? You are a woman, which means I have the right to be pleased by looking at you. Ask yourself how you would feel about a man approaching your daughter this way. I once read an interview with Megan Fox, in which the interviewer felt the need to mention that he had been greeted by Fox with a handshake and not a warm smile. He said it put him off and made her seem cold and withholding. Would an interviewer complain about the same thing if a male actor greeted him with a handshake? He would probably applaud the man's manners. Society expects their women to respond to men with warmth and immediate intimacy. To do anything but must mean the woman is an icy bitch, not simply professional and expecting to be treated as an equal. Asking a woman to smile is either a creepy invasion of personal space or a rude assumption that a woman needs rescuing. We are not damsels in distress. I'm a self-rescuing princess, thank you very much. And even if I were actually in a foul mood, your tiny penis would do nothing but only further bum me out. I assume the only men who can truly understand how annoying this is are the dancers in Las Vegas's Thunder Down Under. Because while every single female on the planet is born with a list of physical expectations stapled to her forehead, only a male stripper can truly understand what it feels like to be marginalized on his looks alone. Men, on average, do not have to worry about this crap. They don't get pulled into an office and told to work on their sexiness for the sake of their job. They can be perfectly respected for their talent without any mention of their looks. And most of them certainly don't have to feel unsafe walking down a street. They don't get accosted by female drivers, who think honking a horn is a polite compliment. I once tweeted that I was offering free to low-cost castrations to any man who enjoyed honking his horn at a chick as a form of mating call. I was blown away by how many guys went on the offensive, reprimanding me for being so ungrateful for the attention. I don't want these men to reproduce, so my offer still stands. He just wanted to let you know you were beautiful, you bitch. So he wanted to compliment me through the use of a startlingly loud noise and then speed off? Using this logic, the next time my guy does the dishes, I will quietly lurk behind him, scream directly into his eardrum, and then run away into the night. No woman likes this, guys. In fact, the second a driver slows to catcall us or honk his horn, we reach for our pepper spray, understandably assuming you are a sexual predator and you intend to stuff us in your trunk. And sure, there might be men listening to this who think, hey, trying to compliment a lady does not make us sexual harassers. Except that it kinda does. Because the actual definition of sexual harassment is this: unwelcome sexual advances, a request for sexual favors, and other verbal or physical harassment of a sexual nature. So, yes, seeing an attractive woman and requesting she open her mouth for you in an ass-backward attempt at being flirty and making a woman feel even the slightest bit like she might be in danger can be a form of sexual harassment. It's important to realize the severity of these actions, because it's a slippery slope from unwanted advances to becoming a red dot on your local sex offender registry. Bitch, why are you taking this shit so seriously? You might ask while telling your wife to stop staring at you for yelling at a book and to get back into the kitchen. Well, sir, because I have seen the worst of these kinds of situations, and it all comes down to assumptions and expectations. It is assumed that as women, we want men to find us attractive. And when we do not appreciate a compliment, some men feel like this is a slap in the face. They assume a compliment was what we wanted. Please note the difference between my guy telling me I look beautiful and a stranger telling me, you got a nice fat ass on you. They assume being extremely forward is flattering and not intrusive. And some men give a bad name to all when they expect the access and opportunity to approach a woman however they see fit. A typical work week in wrestling included 5 days of traveling. It started with 2 flights into a town, a show in that town, 3 to 4 hours of driving to the next town when that show ended around 10 p.m., and repeating this 5 days in a row until taking 2 flights back home. As a woman, occasionally traveling alone, it was important to be aware of my surroundings. When I stopped at a gas station one morning before a show, a man filling up next to me refused to peel his eyes from my ass. I watched as he overflowed his tank with gas and cursed as his shoes got covered in the foul-smelling liquid. That's how inappropriately long and intense he locked onto what my mama gave me. While I finished paying, I noticed him watching me in his car. He had no further business at the gas station, but was not driving away. While I drove to a restaurant to grab some food to take to the arena, I noticed he followed close behind the entire way and simply parked outside, just waiting for me to come out. As I entered the store, I let an employee know I thought I was being followed, and a kind girl and guy walked me back out to my car. When we walked out and I saw him roll his window down despite my having company, I thought the worst of his intentions. He shouted at me, "Hey, has anyone ever told you you're beautiful?" Ignoring him, I got back into my car and drove to the arena, noticing he was still on my tail. As I drove through a security checkpoint, I watched his car bust a U-turn in defeat. What exactly was this guy's game plan? Was he going to follow me in his car all day, showering me with compliments? hoping that one day we would laugh to our children about how Daddy stalked Mommy until she loved him. Or was his plan something more sinister? Luckily, I didn't have to find out. On a scale of 1 through Mayor of Creeptown, this incident barely registered against the type of experiences I've had and the women I've worked with have had. I can guarantee you, they all have anywhere from 5 to 20 stories just like that. So I've learned to keep my guard up. If a guy gives me any reason to worry, as a well-traveled and street-smart woman, I'm going to assume the worst. Because sometimes a guy may start by staring at your ass at the gas station, but then that situation may escalate. As a woman in a sport that can sometimes have small outfits and salacious storylines, there was an odd expectation of access. Sort of like how guys want to take pictures with their arms wrapped around a group of Hooters waitresses. These are women who are meant to be looked at, they think. So naturally, that must mean I have an all-access pass to them. I have had men follow me in dark airport parking lots to try and get a picture. I don't assume the picture part and reach for pepper spray or my keys to defend myself from the guy following me in a dark parking lot. Then they act like I'm the weird one. I've had a father bring his son up to me for a picture and held his small child in one arm as we posed for the photo. He then wrapped his other arm around my waist and squeezed my ass as his friend, jumping to my other side, wrapped his arm around my shoulders and tried to slide his hand down my shirt. These two grown men planned a sexual assault on a woman using a child. Instinctively, I elbowed back at both men and watched as our badass security woman, Muriel Howell, took both men by the back of the neck to airport security. I have had two men follow my car from one state to another, check into my same hotel, and request the room next door to me. And they were actually given it. When I opened my door in the morning, they popped out and asked for autographs. They could have easily just pushed me into my room and attacked me, but that kind of carelessness from a hotel's staff doesn't surprise me. I had one man call my room 5 times, asking if I could meet him for drinks in the hotel bar. When I called the front desk to speak to a manager, turns out it was the manager who had been calling in the first place. And sometimes these hotel interactions aren't so innocent. One female wrestler actually had a maintenance worker use a master key to open her room door while she was asleep at 3 a.m. Luckily, she had the door bolted, but for a terrifying second, she locked eyes with a man who cracked a door open with the cruelest of intentions. So understandably, I feel a little on the offense. How far separated is the guy who can objectify a woman online or while in a moving car because he can anonymously get away with it from a guy who would break into a woman's hotel room because no one would find out? For women who have to endure all levels of sexual harassment every day, the lines begin to blur. But I believe there are plenty of guys who are smart and polite enough to act appropriately with a woman. It's just really hard to hear them over these obnoxious car horns. So nice guys, speak up. Get louder. Whether you see it or not, there are women all around you who would really appreciate being able to pump their gas without feeling in danger. And misogynists, please shut the fuck up. Treat women the way you would want someone to treat your daughter, sister, mother, or wife, or scratch that. Treat women how you want to be treated. Step up. Be kinder. Be smarter. Be better. Or just smile real pretty for me so I can punch you in the teeth. Chapter 12. Extra Whip. I don't believe in anything but myself. I don't believe in fate. I don't believe in destiny, soulmates, or really anything that suggests that I am not the final word in the path I take. It's one of the many reasons I avoid drugs and alcohol. Not only do I respect the power of my brain at full capacity, I relish being in complete control. But there have been moments so coincidental, so fortuitously miraculous, they have made me wonder. When wrestlers had spent a certain amount of time in SCW and could not gain anything more out of the system, the company executives would bring them on the road and choose from one of two options. Either they would let them advance to the main roster in case an extra body was needed, or they would determine their investment was going nowhere and fire them. When after 6 more months in SCW had passed and I was invited on the road, I was sure this was my swan song. But as luck would have it, the wrestlers I would be working with that weekend on house shows were a group of collaborative, talented women. Celeste, the current champion Beth Phoenix, and Layla, whom I already knew I could depend on in the ring. Celeste, known as Caitlin in the ring, and I had become fast friends when I handled her tryout match and she was thrust onto NXT Season 3, 2 weeks after getting hired. She had proven herself to be a hard worker and was full of personality and potential. When we realized we were the only women on the roster with the same asinine, deeply inappropriate sense of humor and strikingly similar upbringings that had made us hardened, sarcastic monsters, we quickly became heterosexual life partners. The four of us worked together seamlessly. I let them all know this may be my last chance at being employed, and so we pulled no punches. At the time, women were not known for taking risks in the ring, so when we put on a tag match that was full of dangerous acrobatic high spots for myself and Layla, and feats of strength for Caitlin and Beth, the producers took notice. I even got an email from the talent relations department congratulating me on the positive reports. I truly believe that match saved my job. Not only that, in May 2011, about 2 weeks later, I finally debuted on WWE television. To make the moment even more cryworthy, I got to debut in a tag team with Celeste. When the announcers approached us before the show and asked if we had a team name, we jokingly told them it was the Chickbusters. Taking us seriously, they actually called us that on television. The match was on the company's B show, SmackDown. We each got one move of offense in, subsequently lost the match, and were warned it might be cut from the taped show's airing because the event had run overtime. But none of that stopped my heart from soaring. I had finally wrestled in a WWE ring. I had finally debuted on the main roster. For a few months, I continued my role as a utility man. NXT had become its own non-competition show, and alongside two other shows called Main Event and Superstars, the three programs were taped before Raw and SmackDown. For many weeks, I would serve double or triple duty, wrestling on NXT, Superstars, and SmackDown, usually getting my butt handed to me and playing the role that suited me best, the underdog. After this went on for some time, I had what is called a squash match against Beth on one of the main shows. In a squash, one person, me, gets relentlessly pummeled for the entirety of the match. It is meant to demonstrate how imposing and unbeatable a wrestler, not me, is. Without realizing I could hear their conversation, Beth, who was the champion at the time, pulled aside the new head of talent relations and put in a good word for me. That was just her third match in one night, and they were all great matches. I hope I'm not the only one that noticed that. Maybe this was just a passing moment in her day. Maybe she was the type of person who was just unabashedly kind, but I would never forget it. She didn't have to stick her neck out for me. She could have insecurely seen another woman as competition. Instead, Beth was open-minded and self-assured. Herself, Layla, and other former champions, Michelle McCool and Eve Torres, would go out of their way to make me feel welcome in the locker room. It was a comforting change from resigning myself to the maintenance closet. These women saw the big picture. We were in this challenging, grueling, nerve-wracking world together, and the way to survive that would be to create a supportive environment. Supporting a fellow female doesn't detract from a woman's strengths. It only makes the pack stronger. It makes us all better. I promised myself I would pay their acts of kindness forward. In every match, I tried to do just that. I knew I had to make myself stand out and perform well, but that didn't have to be at my opponent's expense. We could have better matches when we worked as a unit. I had learned that firsthand, and it wasn't going unnoticed. Because I had put on a solid collection of matches, I was thrown a proverbial bone in the form of a small undercard storyline. The main event storyline was reserved for the top guys. Following that was the mid-card, and beneath that, the undercard. These were the more disposable matches and stories that were the first to get trimmed for time constraints, and they almost always included the women's matches. But getting even the tiniest of opportunities to participate in backstage skits and segments and showcase my personality was mind-blowing. I was paired with Daniel Bryan, a wrestler who was also undersized, atypical for the sport, kind of geeky, but a champion for the fans who saw themselves in him. We were two underdogs who weren't expected to amount to much in the world of giants. One writer, the creator of our pairing, Kevin Eck, lovingly referred to us as his Revenge of the Nerds storyline. Though not much was expected of either of us, due to our inability to fit a mold, we started to fall into opportunities. Several roster injuries and contract negotiations led our little duo into picking up the slack. Though we started as an undercard story, we would end up thrust into the spotlight. This is not a love story. Now, I know that being a person who has unironically worn pigtails in her mid to late 20s might lead people to believe I am someone who is comfortable sharing her orifices. But in actuality, I am a notorious prude and proud of it. Having been trained to avoid embracing my sexuality by an overbearing, often unhinged mother, my puritanical nature began as more of an assigned duty than a choice. But if there was a healthy message to forcibly extract from my mother's extreme method of parenting, it was to not take my value for granted. It was to treat my mind and body with the respect they deserved and demand the world follow suit. Or maybe she just didn't want a slutty kid making her a grandma at 30. Nevertheless, I spent my young adult life treading lightly toward intimacy. A kiss was not a throwaway moment to me. It was to be respected, appreciated. It had to mean something. I loathed the idea of sharing my body trivially. Most of my coworkers assumed I reproduced asexually, like a plant. The majority of the female roster, in their finest professional wear of skin-tight mini-dresses, crop tops, and sky-high heels, leading one to believe the enforced dress code was high-end escort who caters exclusively to politicians, was a stark contrast to my virgin queen style. With my workwear of a cardigan sweater, dark-framed glasses, $20 jeans, and shin-high combat boots, my aesthetic was clearly smooth like a Barbie down there, or at the very least, late-in-life lesbian. But it returned the result of enforced personal space I was looking for. Unfortunately, there's a bit of misguided expectation that comes along with joining a male-dominated business. If you're not going to put out in your first few months on the job, at the very least, a lot of men expect you to stroke their ego and flirt, giggling at unfunny jokes, having boob-to-chest contact on hugs, and laughing off blatant workplace sexual harassment are considered prerequisites of women in the minds of many ignorant men. Knowing this going in, I made an extra effort to make it clear no one had even a remote chance of getting into my jean shorts. I can't help but feel a distinguished pride in being a certified boner killer. Quickly adjusting to my boundaries, the guys were pretty cool, embracing me as a type of little sister rather than potential one-night stand. I was the girl they could talk to about whether Hugh Jackman would make a suitable solid snake. I was the one they felt safe, asking to do recon, sniffing out if they had a chance to hook up with one of the hot ones. They would ask me if whoever I was dating was being good to me, and if there was any guy I wanted them to beat up. One wrestler, the world's strongest man, Mark Henry, actually lifted a local crew guy off his feet and pinned him against a wall after he caught him ogling me as I stretched backstage. I swooned. Another one of the guys, After witnessing a male fan propose to me at an autograph signing, shared, "I sometimes forget that guys think you're pretty. But I enjoy being one of the guys. I've always been more comfortable in the company of like-minded dudes who don't make me worry about what my hair looks like. I made a choice to avoid dating until much later in life because I relished the lack of drama caused by relationships. Life was trying enough already. I was a determined kid who grew into a focused adult, and I didn't want anything to distract me. For what purpose? For love? It wasn't something I entirely believed in. Putting it lightly, I was not a hopeless romantic. In fact, I hate love stories, rom-coms being a particular bane of my existence. Listening to friends complain or gush about who they're dating makes me want to go full Sylvia Plath on a kitchen appliance. When it came to romance, I was less a giggling schoolgirl and more a jaded divorcee in grade school. My general approach to dating was always, meh, no thanks. While my sister Erica made scrapbooks of her dream wedding growing up, cutting out pictures of poofy wedding dresses and listing romantic honeymoon locales, I doubted if I even believed in marriage. I had written it off in kindergarten, somewhere around the time Billy Cook decided leaving his dirty tissues in my cubby and successfully rubbing his chicken-pocked arm on mine meant, "Now you're mine and we have to get married." When we played the game of life and a tile required me to stop and pop a blue peg husband in the plastic car, I would often just spin the wheel again, ignoring the rules. Though occasionally I would concede, only if we all agreed my blue peg could be David Boreanaz. Looking at the heartache my parents had caused each other, I didn't think I wanted any part of what I knew marriage to be. And so for as long as I can remember, I loudly declared that I would never get married. I couldn't understand receiving that kind of unconditional love from someone who did not walk on all fours. I had been taught love and tenderness was dependent on my behavior and on what I could provide. I just didn't trust in the idea that anyone would love me forever. That sounded like a hell of a long time. If I didn't know what to make of my own mother's love, if it came and went with the tide, how would I ever trust a stranger's? I had been so scared of physical contact by the insane parenting approach of my mother that I knew I wouldn't be able to handle dating while living at home. I would have had to hide a relationship and constantly worry about her finding out and drowning me in a bathtub. And besides that, I loved school. All I wanted to do was focus on it and get into a good college and then worry about having a life. Guys in school knew not to try anything because A, they wouldn't get very far, and B, they had heard I had a tendency to crack skulls. Basically, I was every dad's dream daughter. Though, in high school, I did have a major crush that my best friend Sophie would patiently listen to me talk about every day for a year. When, at the end of that year, that guy was found by police having sex with another guy in a porta potty in a public park, I figured it was a sign I was meant to be alone. Technically, my first kiss was at 19. I say technically because when I was 14, my gay friend Chad asked to borrow some chapstick, and when I took too long finding the tube, he just pressed his lips against mine. I was genuinely terrified somehow my mother would be able to tell just by looking at me. When I was 19, I went on my first official date. A cute guy walked into my workplace, and I asked him out. But at the end of the night, when he dropped me off at my front door and leaned in, I jumped back, shouted, no thank you, and ran into my apartment. I was clearly a natural at romance. I wanted my first official kiss to mean something more. I had waited this long, and I wasn't going to waste it on a guy who hadn't asked me a single question the whole night. My first kiss ended up being with a longtime friend who would spend hours, amounting to months, asking me about myself, being genuinely interested in the answers, and simply enjoying my company. He even wrote me a poem once, and not even he could get in my pants. When I was told by a superior that no one wanted to have sex with me, ironically enough, no one had. Though not even my closest friends knew it, I was a virgin well into my 20s. Because I had a varied dating history, that included a white guy, a black guy, and a girl, friends assumed I was a bit experimental. But I wasn't wild. I just didn't have a specific taste. I didn't know what I was looking for. But I knew no one had made me feel safe enough to get my V-card punched. My first year on the main roster, I started dating another wrestler. Greg was my first real adult relationship and my first love. He was my first everything. He was kind, called me beautiful every day, made me birthday gifts by hand, and was close to my family. I felt safe and loved and did not regret it. Waiting until I was mature enough to handle the emotional baggage that comes with sex was worth it. I wish that all girls could fight the peer pressure to grow up fast and sleep around young, because odds are guys that age just aren't worth giving that precious piece of yourself to them. It's only been about 10 years since I was in high school, but the canvas of childhood has changed completely. The mainstream media of my generation idolized Britney Spears, a proud virgin who was considered a scandalous blasphemer for baring her midriff. My favorite young adult television shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Dawson's Creek, and Gilmore Girls, WB Forever, would devote entire seasons to the trepidation leading up to and the consequences after their main characters lost their virginity. Somewhere along the line, through the advent of social media and the popularization of reality TV ditzes, the pop culture compendium targeted toward those not old enough to have a learner's permit has become increasingly, uncomfortably, mature, and overtly sexualized. Kids now enjoy TV shows where every main character shares an HPV strain before the first commercial break. Soon, I would be traveling the world and rocketing toward the limelight. My career became my main focus, and being young and incapable of focusing on two things at once, I started to let my relationship fall to the wayside. I was finally succeeding in the job of my dreams, and to get where I wanted to go, I had to give it my undivided attention. Even though I was being a shitty partner, it still knocked me on my ass when I got dumped. I made a ton of mistakes in the years after. And by mistakes, I mean one of the guys I dated actually wore leather bracelets. If you judge me for one thing in this book, I won't argue if it's that. I almost got wrapped up with another wrestler. While he aggressively courted me, I ignorantly giggled, enjoying the affirming attention. What I didn't realize was that he was secretly dating another woman in the company, and she would understandably hate me forever. Since he had way more stroke than I did, I worried that he would try to have me fired after I told him to back off. But he ended up taking it like a champ, and we just awkwardly passed each other in the halls from there on out. After that, I spent almost a year dating someone who ended up sleeping with one of my best friends. He was then very surprised that it bothered me. Wait, were we supposed to be exclusive this whole time? They weren't all winners. What I should have done while trying to recover from romantic trials and tribulations was lock myself in a room with my dog and cry into a tub of mint chocolate chip ice cream. When trying to re-enter the dating world, I wish I had had a strong female role model to cry to and to help remind me I was worth more. But like most things, I was just going to have to learn the hard way. I guess as humans, our judgment isn't entirely trustworthy during and after heartbreak. But luckily for me, after getting dumped for the first time, live television made for great free therapy. When Brian ended up winning the World Heavyweight Championship in December of 2011, his character was turned into a villain. And thus, growing cocky and power-hungry, he began to mistreat his dutiful lady. When he dumped me on screen for inadvertently costing him his championship, I laughed at the ironic timing. I was sure my run in the storyline was over, but it was amazing while it lasted. Two underdogs had won the hearts of the crowd, dominated ratings, and made an impact no one expected. People really cared about what was going to happen to these characters next. And so, the suits in charge were forced to take notice. Though they didn't understand our appeal, I was pleasantly surprised and impressed when they began thinking of ideas to bring us back together and further the storyline. It was a bold move to use two characters who didn't abide by the proven formulas in such a prominent way. The writers and decision makers took a brave risk with us, and we would prove that we were worth it. It was easy to play the heartbroken mess with an unrequited love when I spent each night crying into my hair over being dumped. What astonished me was how therapeutic it was to show my raw emotions on screen under the guise of performance. I twisted my real-life heartache into the broken character, and it was thrilling to blur the line between the two. I knew exactly how hurt and pathetic the character on screen should be feeling, and being so accidentally open about it made the healing process fly by. Not swallowing my pain like a bag of razors, but instead allowing myself to be vulnerable and work through it actually made me feel better. Who would have thought taking a healthy approach, however alternatively, would help? Using my personal life as fuel, I was accidentally oversharing myself with the audience. I was a raw, honest, bleeding heart and was being cheered for it instead of mocked. This was fascinating to me. In life, we try our hardest to save face, to seem tough and unfazed, and to never let our exes know they affected us. But in the world of make-believe and escapism, people want to vicariously express themselves through you. They want to see someone expose all the emotions they are too proud to share. They want assurance that there are others out there who feel their pain. And so when a character on TV openly shares this experience and vulnerability, they connect to it. Watching me cause havoc, stalk my ex, fuck up his life, and act out in rage was like therapy for everyone watching who had ever been dumped. What I learned was that the key to success was going to be showing my genuine emotion, being open and honest. When you can accept and be proud of your flaws, they will become your greatest strength. Then I was faced with a moral dilemma. It blew my mind that only months after being told no one wanted to take me behind the school and get me pregnant, I was given this opportunity to enter a main event storyline. To seem ungrateful in any way would be shooting myself in the foot. But when I found out what was planned for the character next, I couldn't help but speak up. Some writers had pitched my character would become the crazy ex-girlfriend. At first, that sounded intriguing, as I was having fun being the vengeful ex-girlfriend, until I found out what that entailed. The plan was for my crazy to be a point of levity in the show. A series of goofy skits in which this nutter revenge-kissed a leprechaun and danced with dinosaurs from outer space. I am not exaggerating. That was an actual plan. We were going to make a joke out of mental illness. Sure, WWE wasn't an after-school special, but after everything I had gone through with not only my mother but myself, mocking an affliction that deeply affected me was not something I was interested in. There are those who stand by their code, and those who just talk about it real loud. So many people think they are capable of making just and moral decisions in life, but when actually confronted with an opportunity to gain something out of bending their beliefs, they fold. That is not who I am. I knew speaking against these plans might be the end of my career. Not only was I a newbie on the roster, but I was a woman. Everyone assumed I should just be grateful to be used in something other than a 30-second 10-woman tag match. But did being grateful mean compromising what I believed in? Not only from a moral standpoint, but also from a business one. Being relatable and true to myself was quickly turning me into a fan favorite. I didn't want to ruin that by doing something disingenuous, something I couldn't put my heart behind. I've agreed to do countless, ridiculous things on screen. I've worn fat suits, muscle suits, comically large boobs, and comically small cowboy hats. I've danced, done limbo competitions, ridden a mechanical bull, thrown temper tantrums, and had the sky rain poop on me. I am down for almost anything. If I think something is funny, I don't have a problem looking like an ass. There are few things more fun than making a fool of yourself and not giving a damn. But this pitch was unlike those things. I didn't think it was funny, and I thought it would hurt my mother's feelings. And so, I said no. 2 months into my first and only real storyline, I turned my bosses down. As a rule of thumb, I'll never say no to something without suggesting an alternative option. It's just a smart thing to do if you want to healthily collaborate with people. So I pitched we take things a darker route. I suggested instead of making the character a caricature of a mentally ill person, why not explore how dangerous that illness could make her? I wanted her to truly be broken, vulnerable, clingy, and downright unsettling. If simply being heartbroken on camera had garnered so much support, embracing the even more extreme flaws humans keep hidden away inside of themselves would be the ultimate catharsis for the audience. Instead, I was taken off television for 2 months as punishment. But after those 2 months, my old friend, convenient circumstance, showed up again. Brian was going to be wrestling for another heavyweight title, and the writers wanted to throw a red herring into the mix. Suddenly, using my idea worked in the grand scheme the writers were putting together. My character was reintroduced, integrating my wishes to play her dark and unpredictable. So now I had an opportunity. If I didn't want her to be a joke, then what did I want her to be? Embracing the side effects of a broken relationship had initially been the catalyst for my connection to the audience. So I knew I had to continue exploring the depths of emotion within me. If I wanted to play crazy more truthfully, I only needed to look in a mirror. I knew what kind of darkness could exist inside of me. Years of living unmedicated had shown me the altered reality my eyes were capable of seeing. I knew exactly how twisted and torn my thoughts could become. Those feelings, though at bay, were only a short trip away. But facing them wasn't easy. I had spent so long ignoring my bipolar disorder, I was still used to being in denial about it, and sometimes untrained in controlling it. Would reaching deep down and pulling it to the surface only serve in helping it to consume me? Or would it be the perfect way to hide in plain sight? I had asked to be the face of proper crazy, and now it was my responsibility to do it right. I got in touch with the deep, dark corners of my mind I had tried to never look at for too long. Even in people who don't have bipolar disorder, there are warped desires and perverse instincts they fight to keep hidden. Having bipolar disorder means those instincts jump to the surface without worry of repercussions. I decided that was exactly who I needed to be on screen. An amalgamation of rash, selfish, frightening behavior. I picked the worst qualities I knew I was capable of, and my character proudly shouted them from the rooftops. When an ex hurt my feelings, I took it out on the friend trying to console me. If a girl looked at me wrong, I swung until she bled. I stalked my ex's every move from the shadows and played every childish game to make him jealous. I knew how to play these appalling actions because somewhere inside of me, they existed. When my character had to have several emotional breakdowns, I could feel my heart beat with trepidation, giving in to crying fits and losing myself in animalistic screaming was the most raw and truthful I could be about my disorder while still under the guise of make-believe. "You're really good at playing crazy," Vince McMahon, the owner of the company, told me after I returned backstage from an in-ring temper tantrum. But to me, I wasn't playing crazy. I was discovering my superpower. The writers wanted to make the audience wonder if our breakup had been a ruse designed to curry favor with Brian's opponent, only to help him win the title. I was back in the game, and I learned my lesson to never speak up again. Wait, no, that part didn't happen, I was snarkier than ever. Initially, the plan was to tease this reconciliation for a month and ultimately have Brian win the title, making us a heel couple. But as more players entered the story, it became too much fun for the writers to cut short. The current holder of the title we were intended to steal was CM Punk, covered in tattoos, with an irreverent attitude and a general distaste for authority and freshly laundered clothes. Punk, aka Phil, was the rebellious anti-hero the crowd went crazy for. A stark contrast to the all-American, fresh-faced, drink-your-milk-kids success stories that had preceded him. Another contender for the title was the masked giant and devil's favorite demon, Kane. Real name, Glenn. It was a bit of a letdown learning these badass characters actually had the names of very white accountants. His character was a 7-foot burn victim who only found pleasure in bringing other people pain. I had a poster of Kane over my bed when I was 13, so eventually having to straddle and make out with him on live television made for a bizarre experience, albeit a proud moment for my dad. My character stalked, harassed, and drove all three guys insane in a soap opera-worthy, unrequited love square. Because even with three other losers hanging around, AJ Lee could not get laid. I would cost them matches and then flip on a dime and try to help them win some. It was never clear whose side I was on or if my charms were possibly working. It was ridiculous, soapy, brazen entertainment. It had been a long time since our programming had featured such a relationship-heavy, emotionally-driven storyline. It was groundbreaking and a brave step in a new direction. And that is why the fans jumped on board. They were excited to see something different. They were intrigued to see a woman utilized for more than a bathroom break match. The four of us were quite the motley crew of freaks and geeks not suitable for television, but something about it worked. We were like the Guardians of the Galaxy for the wrestling world, a bunch of cast-offs who surprisingly worked well together. Anti-heroes in an anti-love story making bad decisions was a surprise hit for the ratings. What was supposed to be a one pay-per-view deal dominated a summer of television in 2012. I got to wreak havoc, work with my childhood heroes, and introduce a new kind of woman in professional wrestling, a woman who, when given the opportunity, could captivate an audience with her words and performance, and not just her looks. A woman who could show range and layers of personality. The fans had spoken and wanted to see more of this kind of role for their heroines. They really dug Crazy Chicks. Over the next year, I was the first woman in close to a decade to appear on a pay-per-view poster, naturally tying a man to a railroad track while a train barreled down on him. The designers really got me. I was voted the most influential female athlete on Twitter, beating out Serena Williams. I made it into my first of three video games and had not one, but six action figures made in my likeness. I was the first woman to open and close the company's flagship television show, and I became one of only a handful of women in the company's history to wrestle in that show's main event. Not bad for someone so unfuckable. Mad Girls Love Song. There is a locker room in Corpus Christi, Texas, that smells of my dirty shame. After the salacious opening segment of our show, I ran here to escape the prying eyes and suspicious questions of my coworkers. I couldn't shake what had just happened. The mixed emotions and racing thoughts rattled around my brain as I collected my padded bras and the plethora of unused clothing options that lay sprawled over a folding table. I sloppily chucked them back into my colossal off-brand luggage, the one that, on occasion, I have felt the need to physically prove was large enough to fit my entire body. I couldn't quite figure out why I was packing so early in the show, but I needed to move, to keep busy, in order to prevent my brain from short-circuiting. With stillness came a flood of images, a flipbook of the dirty deed just done in front of thousands of strangers. With the images came a jarring feeling in my gut, like a fist squeezing and then twisting my intestines. Mistakenly slowing down to fold a hooded sweatshirt was just the opportunity my racing mind needed to replay the moment. My gut squeezed. Through a tornado of skull-emblazoned t-shirts and travel-sized soaps, I watched Celeste, my work wife, best friend on the road, and most trusted confidant, rush into the room.